Okay, first of all, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Today is February 17th, 2008. It is Sunday, and we're back. I know that you fellas have an exam in Yoredeya coming up, so it affects... Baruch Hashem, I have a lot of students via the website, but let me tell all the students listening, our ranks are thin here. It's already exam time, weddings, going back to the States, and I'm happy no one told me they're going back for spring training to catch a look at the Yankees. Where are they? Down in Florida? Where are they training? I don't even know. Okay, but I, despite that, I have a lot to do today, and tomorrow's a very special day. I have pictures that are one of a kind tomorrow. So instead of charging you $99,000, the pictures will be on the house, but it'll be well worth your coming. I can't believe what I came up with this time. So, kol hakavod to my student in Brooklyn, who supplied me with the wonders of the world. Okay, now, today is very important. I want to tie a lot of loose ends together. And what's interesting is, generally speaking, the Sunday class has more lumbus and the Monday class is more of a lecture. This week is the opposite. The Sunday class is more of the lecture and the Monday class will have unbelievable makorot. What we finished up, we've been dealing for weeks on the question of the Judenrat cooperating with the Nazis. And you're dealing here with the Psak of the Rambam, in Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, Perek Hey, that Chas V'Chalila, that we Jews should surrender another Jew, even if the Gentiles single him out. And it could even be, even if he's Chayav Mitah, even if he's incurred a death penalty. You saw what happened with Eliyahu HaNavi, the Yerushalmi, and the Psak of the Rambam, that in the first instance, we don't want to surrender him no matter what, and al-achat kamav akama, where he's not chayav. And yet, the Kovna Rav, when it came to the question of the Kovna Ghetto, the Kovna Rav paskined after fainting and staying up all night, he paskined, cooperate, draw up the list, surrender, because if you don't draw up the list, the Nazis will take more. And this machloket, this question, did he do the right thing, didn't he do the right thing, this question rebounds throughout the history of the Judenrat, throughout the history of World War II. It comes up time and again. In modern scholarship, a guy named Aaron Rakefet asked the Rav this very question, and you will recall what the Rav answered him, and I gave you the sources in writing today, that the Rav Taka said that the Kovna Rav acted against Halacha. It was an instinctive reaction. It was the Holocaust. I would have reacted the same way, but you're right, it's against the Halacha. He didn't only answer me that way. He answered the question he got in the mid-50s when he was giving that public lecture, which is later written up by Moshe Kroner. And it's fascinating that you don't have to depend upon memory. You don't have to take my word for it because it's right there in black and white. Dr. Esther Farbstein, the wife of the Chevron of Rosh Yeshiva, the niece of the Gerer Rebbe, did a doctorate in Hebrew U, and it's a bestseller today, Beseter Ra'am, although your first name is David? Baruch. Okay, 1 second, let me get your name down. Baruch, and what's your last name?
Pelta.
P-E-L-T-A. Pelta, Baruch Pelta, and you brought a friend today. Okay, Beseda, we'll worry about his name. If the friend surfaces again, we'll worry about his name. Baruch, the world is not allowed to know. She got a doctorate because Sapashnish, the Heaven of Rosh Yeshiva's wife, gets a PhD at university, but these are the facts. And as you learned Friday night, there are facts and there are facts. These are the facts. So in her doctorate, she is critical of Aaron Rakefet, and she says that I'm, and I tried. I came up with an answer. I came up with a big chiddush based upon the Noda B'Yehuda that Lahatzolat Klal Yisrael, the rules are different. and self-survival of the Jewish people is Doicha Kol HaTorah Kula, and I based myself upon the Noda B'Yehuda. Last year, before I left for the States, I brought in many sources that the Noda B'Yehuda is based upon, even though he did not quote them all, but the Beit Yaakov that he quotes is quoting I showed you the Shvut Yaakov, and I showed you the Marik, which is already a Rishon, and they all have the same attitude. Tzolot Klal Yisrael, the halacha moves on a different level. And that's the way I publish Chiddushei Torah, to justify the Kavna Rav Spasak. Esther Farbstein and Beseita Ram, or Ram Beseita, or Beseita Ram, Beseita Ram, I don't want to start looking, but I believe it's Beseita Ram, in her volume, criticizes me and says, Chas v'chalila, to say that the Kavna Rav, even to think that he acted incorrectly, and she develops the idea that he didn't really know. It was Beseita Ram, that's the title. She develops the idea that he didn't really know, and it was a question of if you don't cooperate, they'll get angry, but no one was going to be killed. And that was her approach. Now, in our last class, we came to the Bible on the Judenrat. The Bible on the Judenrat is a major work by Yeshaya Trunk. What's interesting is, with all the greatness of the internet that you guys live by, and I see my son-in-law who sits and learns all day, I never saw him hold a sefer. I've yet to see Reb Chaim hold a sefer. He's sitting at the computer and he's working away and working away. All right, you're in a different world. I recognize that. And I'm not saying your world is better or my world is better, but this is the reality. I'm yet sitting in front of the Rav, and you're pushing into modern technology. You're 50 years ahead of me, which is the way it should be. So one second, I started to talk about the computer that got lost and sidetracked. With all the computerization, we could not come up with Yeshaya Trunk's biography. I have a feeling he's an enikel of the great Rabbi Yeshua Yisrael Trunk, who was very much involved in the Hetta Mechira with the Kutna Rav. I have a feeling he may be a grandson. The age is right, the times fit together. Unfortunately, he's not alive anymore, so there's no way we can ask him. But with all that we searched the internet, we could not come up with this detail. What is important is that he wrote the Judenrat in Yiddish. It was written basically in America, and he himself was a survivor. And it's considered the Bible until today. It has been translated into Hebrew. There may be other translations. It's the book that everyone goes back to, everyone refers to. Now, in the Judenrat, there are endless pages showing that this machloket was not just limited to Kovno, what we mentioned now. It was in every ghetto. The machloket repeated itself time and again. And of course, the Rambam stares you in the eyes. How can you go and cooperate? How can you go and pick out Jews? And you had people who headed up the various communities, who headed up the various Judenrats, who generally went against the Rambam, went like the Kavna Rav, and justified their actions and made speeches. And we have memoir literature, these speeches survived, the justification survived. Some of them got so carried away that they actually viewed themselves in semi-messianic terms. And let me quote some of the justification. There are a number of people. There's Yaakov Genz. He was in one Judenrat. There's Moshe Meron. He was in another Judenrat. There were people, good Jews. Remember, I told you, the Judenrat were not capos. I knew some people who survived who had been members of Judenrat. They were fine, wonderful, upright Jews, Talmidei Chachamim. And yet, imagine to face this quagmire. And here you have a quote on page 421, Yaakov Genz. This is in 1942. Mind you, all the quotes I'll be giving you are from 41 and 42. What does that tell you? 41, 42 is exactly when Rabbi Ephraim Ushri's question came up and the Kovner Rub's question came up. And it's naive to say that they didn't realize that they're selecting and they're cooperating and they're helping the Nazis kill Jews. It's naive to say that, because this was going on in every community and the dates are exactly the same. It's 41, 42, late 41, early 42. It corresponds to exactly the questions we asked in Kovna. And remember, Kovna is further into Lithuania. This already began in Poland, it began already in White Russia, it comes to Lithuania, and Kovner is further into Lithuania, and Jews were escaping and running back and forth and running to ghettos and hiding and moving away from the Nazis, and they brought the news of what was happening. If you read Eli Wiesel's, The Night, I believe. Am I right? The Night. Okay, say that my memory is good. But I know it. He wrote it originally in French. It's still Yiddish. It's translated into English. So you read that work, you see how the Shamus is running away from Poland to Romania, and he tells them what's happening in Poland, and no one believes him. Everyone thinks he's crazy. But you see that people are running away. And here you have Yaakov Genz recorded by someone who survived the Holocaust. And this is the speech that he attributes to him. It is true that our hands are smeared with the blood of our brethren, but we had to accept this horrible task. We are innocent before history. We shall be on the alert to preserve the remnants. Who can tell whether victims will not be demanded here in Vilna as they were demanded in Asminan, that was another community that there already had been a selection. We shall give only the sick and the old. We shall not give the children. They are our future. We shall not give the young woman. A demand has been made to deliver workers. My answer was, we shall not give them, for we need them here ourselves. And you see right away, this is the cheshbon ha-nefesh. Who do you surrender? Who do you give? Who do you keep? Notice that even at these darkest moments, the heads of the Judenrat were hoping against hope that there would be a remnant that survived. You understand that this is an amazing thought, that throughout the Hitler period, as dark as it was, they were convinced someone would survive. And their task was to guarantee that who should survive? The young, the capable. There should be a tomorrow. This is why the survival of women is so important. Because without women, we can't have children. One man can impregnate many women, but you must have women to have children. This is why children are so important, because their life is before them, their strength is before them. And this theme repeats itself time and again. Now, this is Yaakov Genz. This is a speech that he gave. The Jewish police took no part in this action. And he describes two communities where the Judenrat refused to help the Nazis. So all were slaughtered there. Could you imagine? He's telling you Eidet Nemanah, and he mentions, the names are unimportant now, but he mentions the communities where the Judenrat followed the Rambam literally. All were slaughtered. Jews from the surrounding towns have come here now and begged for help. I could have told them that I do not wish to smear my hands and send my police to do the filthy work. But I said, yes, it is my duty to foul my hands. After 5 million have been slaughtered, it is our duty to save the strong and the young and not let sentiment overcome us. I am not sure that everyone has understood what I have said, or that people will justify our deeds after we are liberated from the ghetto. But this is what the police think: to save whomever possible. Our personal emotions notwithstanding, I expect moral support from you. And here you have the exact words, the exact tragedy that they recognize. They're killing Jews, they're making selection, they're deciding who shall live and who shall die. And yet if we don't make this selection, endless more will die. Now when he talks of the police, he means the Jewish police. He means the police of the Judenrat. He's not talking about the SS. They had to surrender the Jews. They had to give them over. They had to say who could work and who couldn't work. Now, someone hearing his speech writes afterwards, "It is horrible, perhaps, the worst of all predicaments. Still, there is no other way. Blessed be the God of Israel who sent us this man, Jacob Gins." The young people, the ghetto police, have accepted this dreadful duty. The result, over 400 souls have perished. Elderly people, the weak, the retarded children. However, 1,500 women and children were saved. If this had been the work of strangers, 2,000 people would have perished. So you see, once again, the theme stares you right in the eye. And here's Eitan Nemana from a survivor who blesses Jacob Gins that the man had the guts to make these decisions, to decide who shall live and who shall die. And as a result of that, only, what was the figure? 400 perished. Had he not, who knows how many? Perhaps 2,000 would have perished. And it goes on and on. Page 422, you have a very strong proof to my thesis and the proof against Dr. Esther Farbstein, because in the volume, Trunk relates that Jacob Gins personally participated in the removal to pottery of the Jews from the Vilna ghetto in the fall of 1941. Now, how many of you have been to Vilna? If you've been to Vilna, pottery is just the forest, the area right beyond Vilna. And endless Jews, Lower Lena, were killed in pottery. How far is Vilna from Kovna? It is impossible that they didn't hear in Kovna about what was happening in Vilna and about these Jews being removed from the Vilna ghetto and being slaughtered in pottery. There's a big monument there today. Kovna is the closest big city to Vilna. Notice the date, fall of 1941. So you see the date, you see right away, everyone understood. This is why the Kovner fainted. These decisions were life and death. It was not just, you're going to rebel against the authorities, you're going to upset the authorities, you're going to ruffle their feathers. Pinchas, this was life or death. And everyone knew it. And I stand on my thesis. I may be wrong. Maybe the Rebbe is right. We acted against halacha. I don't think so. I don't want to think so. I defended myself. But let me go further. Yes, Michael.
How can you believe that this was the last election?
So I'm going to read more quotes that are even more shocking. Michael, have you studied psychology? You see, you ask yourself a simple question. You drive, okay? You're driving on the highway. And lo and behold, you know what they call rubbernecking. It's a term that I never understood. I've learned what the term means. They use it in America.
It's a strategy.
Right. What are you looking at? You're looking at a tremendous crash. Three cars smacked up. Ambulances all over the place. And yet you continue driving. Why do you continue driving? Logically speaking, sakonet nefasha, park the car, walk away, and never drive again. Right or wrong? You know what happened to us on the way back from America? I took an earlier flight on Wednesday, so to be home on Thursday midday and have time to unpack and get ready for Shabbos and catch my breath and be able to teach as I taught last Sunday. We're on, not only on time, we're early. The plane is jammed. El Al, I don't know how they do it. If there were empty seats, they were on top of the plane, not in the plane. Plane is jammed. Close the doors. We're on the runway. Literally, early, not just on time. And right as we're ready to take off, the plane before us, imagine, it's already in motion to take off. Something went wrong, stopped, motor is worthless, the plane had to be towed away, we're delayed 1 hour. We were literally sitting behind them, delayed 1 hour. No, if you have any seichel, you say to yourself, what am I, crazy? I'm going up in the air and this bird, the plane, imagine had that plane taken off. God have mercy, what could have happened 3 minutes after takeoff? And yet no one got off the plane. Everyone is sitting there. So you see, there's a defense mechanism, a healthy defense mechanism that a human being has to live with. That defense mechanism simply means you have confidence that somehow it's going to work out. You have confidence you're going to succeed. If you don't have that feeling, you become a psycho case. There are people who don't take elevators. Have you met that? There's a technical name. I don't know what it is, but anyone who studies psychology, I once heard a technical name for people who are afraid to take elevators. There are people, I had a Rebbe who told us about in Europe, they were Rebbeim, they didn't sit under a chandelier. They did not sit under a chandelier. They said, you see the chandelier is hanging. What's it hanging by? By one screw, basically. No, a chandelier hanging by one screw. Why should I sit under the chandelier? So this ability to think you're going to survive, to think you're going to live, to think there's going to be a tomorrow. If not for that, no one would have survived. We would have all given up. And remember I explained to you Kastner, the one major trial that happened after World War II was the Kastner trial, where he was accused of cooperating and choosing this one, not choosing that one, and afterwards he's assassinated on the streets of Tel Aviv. But what's amazing about Kastner, why did he choose whom he chose for that train? Remember? And remember, this is a Jewish agency employee. And he's choosing, besides his family, which I say he had every right to choose, Adam Karev Yetzel Atzmo, but he chose secular Zionists, he chose Jewish communists, he chose Jewish socialists, he chose Mizrahiites, he chose Nagudistim, he chose the Satmar Rebbe, he chose Satmar. And after the war, no one understood why did he choose these people. And the answer was, he had a whole theory, Noah's Ark, that the Jewish world will be reconstructed, and in order to reconstruct it, let's have a little bit of everything we had before. But you see, could you imagine that we have a theory? We're going to reconstruct. And this is what kept them going, and this is why they could speak the way they spoke. Here, I'll quote to you from Moshe Meron. This is a speech from 1942, where they accuse him of being a murderer. He was the head of the Yudenrat. He selected Jews and he cooperated. And this is what he says. Nobody will deny that as a general, I have won a great victory. If I have lost only 25% when I could have lost all, who can wish better results? And here he says it openly. I'm a general. I'm fighting a war. No? Imagine you go into battle and I could have lost everybody. I only lost 25%. Isn't that a great victory? This is the way they're speaking. This was the psychology of the moment. Here, he quotes on page 423 a speech made by, again, one of the heads of the Judenrat. And these speeches were recorded by people listening, people who survived afterwards. And here you have this person saying, I did not come to console you today. I did not come to quiet you down either, but to reveal to you the whole woeful, torturing truth. I came like a robber to rob your dearest ones from your very hearts. With all my might, I strove to repeal this evil order. And as it has been impossible to rescind it, I tried to make it milder. And then he goes into a whole description how the Nazis agreed they will not take children 10 years of age. And he says, I fought with them that they shouldn't take children 9 years of age either. But they refused to give in to me. But at least this single age group, 10 years of age, I was able to succeed. They did not relent. I have succeeded in saving the 10-year-olds. And he says, like the other one, I'm a general. I could have lost everyone. I only lost 25%. We have in the ghetto, listen to his description, many people sick with tuberculosis, whose lives are numbered in days, perhaps in weeks. I do not know. Perhaps it is a satanic idea. And again, perhaps it is not. But I cannot restrain myself from mentioning it. Deliver to me those sick ones, and it may be possible to save the healthy ones instead. I am well aware how dear the sick are to everyone. It is particularly so among the Jewish people. But in times of disaster, one has to weigh and measure who to be saved, who can and should be saved. To my mind, those are to be spared in the first place who have any chance of survival, not those who cannot survive anyway. Excuse me, the city, it's Rumakovsky, and it's the report of Joseph Zelkovich, and it's a city in Upper Silesia, which is beyond Kovna. And this, what I quoted, is from the middle of 1942. And I can go on and on in one ghetto after another. This battle was fought. And then, beginning on page 424, he goes into a description of Kovna. And everything we spoke about in class is here in the Judenrat. And he tells the results, that as a result of the cooperation, some 9,000 people were taken away and killed as a result of the Judenrat cooperating with the Nazis. So here you see they were transported to the 9th Fort and killed. So you see clearly that there was nothing between the selection and death. It was a selection for death, and the Judenrat knew about it. Now, he goes on and on describing the machloket and the rabbanim, and the rabbanim at times were asked what to do, and the rabbanim many times simply couldn't give an answer. There were communities where they did follow the Rambam. Once they saw that everyone was killed, then afterwards they changed and they cooperated to minimize the death, to do what they can. Some of these people who had to make these life and death decisions simply, I would use the word, went out of their minds as a result. They viewed themselves as Moshe Rabbeinu. They viewed themselves as Messiah. They viewed themselves as saving the Jewish people, and they view themselves as being sent by God. And all these people who made these speeches and justified themselves, unfortunately, no one survived. They quote here one of the leaders, Merins, and his first name was Moshe, and they quote Moshe Merin as telling his secretary, Fanny Krasny, that he had heard an inner voice calling to him, quote, You, Moshe, are chosen to redeem your people out of Hitler's bondage, even as your namesake freed the Jews from the bondage of Egypt. And I can go on and on with quotes, Lo Aleinu. It was a tremendous, horrendous question, tragedy, but overall, the Judenrat followed the psak of the Kavna Rav, and it was Latzolat Klal Yisrael, and they made these terrible decisions. Okay, so the rest of it you can read about in the Judenrat. It's a fascinating volume, and for those of you that are direct descendants of Holocaust survivors, it's required reading, required study, required understanding. But I want to come to a very interesting point now. This question of cooperation, this horrible question of giving Jews over, surrendering Jews. Did we have precedents? Did we ever have this problem before? And here you come to a very fascinating story. I believe it was the third president of the State of Israel, which Shneur Zalman Rubishov, who went with the name Shazar. Shazar is the Rashi Tevet for his original name, Shneur Zalman Rubishov. When you Hebraize a name, there has to be something behind the way you Hebraize your name. Rakefet is an anagram on Rothkopf. It's the same letters, simply arranged differently. Shazar took his Rashi Tevet and became President Shazar. I had the privilege of meeting him on a number of occasions. Shazar was a very interesting individual, if you know his life story. What does the name Shneur Zalman tell you? Menachem Mendel, what does it tell you? No. With the name Menachem Mendel, what was the first question I asked you? How did your Zayda, my Rebbe, Reb Noach Bornstein, allow such a name into the family? Remember your answer to me? You had another grandfather, Baruch Hashem. What does Shneur Zalman tell you? He was born a Chabadnik. And he was caught up, it's Gevena Yingel Mitpeyas, Chabad kid. He was caught up in the holy revolution against what they perceived, against Torah, Zionism, conquering the world, moving into a new sphere. All that was involved in the Zionist movement in its nascent development. Later in life, he became very, very famous. He was a writer, an author. He was the editor of the Mapai newspaper, of the Davar, a paper that doesn't exist today, but it doesn't have to because Yediot and Mariv are more to the left than Mapai ever was. Yediot in particular. And they set the tone of the country because they sell more copies a day than the New York Times. No one realizes that the New York Times sells under 800,000 copies a day. They make a fortune out of related activities. The truth is, the New York Times could be given away every day, and just out of the advertisements, if they gave it away free, they'd make more money, because then they could claim to give out 2 million copies a day, and the advertisements would cost more. So the Yediot is something like 900,000 sales a day. It's beyond description. And they set the tone for the country. That's why Olmert is still in power. That's why the Winograd Report is low-keyed. That's why Ramon could put his... I don't even want to say what he did. And then he totally got away with it 100%. The press, unfortunately. In democracy, there is a real problem with the influence that the press has on democratic institutions. And in Israel, you see it up close, because it's a life and death situation here. So in his middle age, Shazar returned to his youth. And there was the famous story where he visited America in the early 70s, I believe it was. I was living in Israel already, and maybe 69, 70, and the president of the State of Israel went to 770 to visit the Rebbe, and they went crazy here. What a disgrace. The president of Israel is going to see some rabbi in Crown Heights, and it's a disgrace for the presidency, and the rabbi has to come to the king and not vice versa. And Shazar, and they went crazy. You have no idea what a cause celebre was. And Shazar commented, I don't understand them. I may be president of Israel, but I'm a chassid who wants to see his Rebbe. And he went to see the president. There are pictures of it. Chabad, had a lot of publicity out of it. So in his middle age, when he became president, it was like he introduced a minion in the president's house. He had Kiddush every Shabbos in 68 when I visited as a tourist with rabbinical council. He made a Kiddush for the RCA, and it's given Avraham Chaimish Yid returned to his roots. He ran a study circle. And in that study circle, they met once a month perhaps. It was a study circle where they had professors from the various universities in Israel lecture on a topic of Jewish interest. And one of the topics at the lectures that Shazar sponsored was this very question of the cooperation with the Nazis for what the Kovnerov Paskind, for what the heads of the Judenrat did, generally speaking. Not in all places, as I told you in Trunk's major work, you will see pages after pages. Most places cooperated. Some never did. Some shifted gears when they saw they lost so many people by not cooperating, so they saw it was to their advantage to cooperate. So the question came up, were there precedents? And there was a lecture in front of the president, Dr. Jacob Robinson, who was a historian, delivered a paper, and they made a golden point that evening. My dear students, there was a precedent, the Cantonists. What am I talking about? And without getting involved in contemporary arguments that broke out in the greater YU world, let me state the facts. And Trunk has it at the very end, beginning on page 435. He describes that particular lecture at the president's home by Dr. Robinson. We know in Russia the Jews suffered greatly. And Tsar Nicholas I issued an edict in 1827, I quote, it is the responsibility of the Jewish community to see to it that military service for Jews, when ordered by the governor, is punctually accomplished. Now, mind you, what this military service meant is that kids as young as 12 were taken into the Russian army for 25 years. It's not the Israeli army. Those of you that have done Hezda, you know very well, you do Hezda, so you're in active service a year and a half, 2 years, and then you're back in yeshiva. You're in Miluim like everyone else. I was in Miluim. I served 14 and a half years after basic training. But it's not like the Israeli army. You're talking 25 years. Now you think for a moment, how much of a chance is there that a Jewish kid drafted at 12, put into the Russian army, is going to remain a Jew, going to remain from? They were enticed and offered every reward later to convert to Russian Orthodox. Some converted. Many, despite the terrible circumstances, remain good Jews. But how did the Russian government enforce this? And this went on, again, 1827, to 1856. It's very important because it later becomes a big machloket on the Yusin, and you have to know what the exact years are. You'll see, I'll mention it later, remind me. Now, if the Jewish communal leaders did not provide the soldiers, the law as decreed by the Tsar called for them to be drafted themselves. Do you understand how cruel this was? You're taking communal leaders and you're telling them that we want, for the sake of argument from this community, 25 Jewish boys between the ages of 12 to 16. And we're taking them for 25 years. If you do not surrender these boys to us, and you do not meet the quota, we will take you in their stead. Okay? And now you get involved. Who do you select? Now, the government itself later passed a law exempting from conscription rich traders, members of the merchants' guilds, officially appointed rabbis, but not their children, honor graduates of elementary and high schools, or licensed skilled workers employed by factories owned by Jews, and farm laborers, all in very short supply among the Jews. So you see, there are many exceptions. Anyone that had a job, anyone that could do something, anyone that was a prospective gain for the Russian population, we don't want him in the army. So who did the burden fall on? Generally the poor kids and the underprivileged. Who went to school? Tell me, who went to school? Who had money? Who could go to high school? Who could go to college? Who could go to university? You had to have money. The poor kids had no money. And think what we're talking about here. If I can make an analogy in your world, a father came over to me 2 weeks ago in Queens with tears in his eyes. His son has returned from Israel, a Talmud Chacham, Yirei Shamayim, studied here 2 years. The kid is desperate to go to YU. You know what the tuition is in YU today? The tuition with the dormitory, you're talking on to $40,000 a year. You're talking mega sums. All right, they give aid and they let you make loans, but you know, who wants to make endless loans? You mortgage your whole career, you mortgage your life. No, is this fair? What's going to happen in YU? The wealthy kids wind up in YU, and the kids who don't have that money have to wind up in second-rate colleges. It's a problem. But switch now to the Cantonist, to being a Cantonist, to being a soldier. Imagine 25 years to be uprooted from your family. And who does the burden fall on? The poor kids, the underprivileged. And here you have, for the first time that we know of, where the leaders of the Jewish community employed kidnappers, snatched kids away from their parents, did everything possible to see to it that they met the quota. They didn't want to be jailed. They didn't want to be drafted. They didn't want to be penalized. They didn't want to pay unbelievable fines, 1,000 rubles for every kid missing. When you think of 1,000 rubles in terms of today's money, you're thinking like $100,000 that they were obligated personally. They did everything in their power to meet the quota. But in order to meet that quota, they were making a selection. We learned from contemporary literature and from memoirs of former Cantonists that the community leadership themselves made some kind of selection of expendable persons. Religious scholars, young Torah students, and generally boys with sharp brains, quote unquote, who might have been expected to produce future cadres of scholars and rabbis, were spared as far as possible. And for good reason. The community wanted to survive. The community wanted wanted to live on. The community wanted to have leadership. So look who they chose. They chose the weakest, the poorest, the defenseless. And I want to quote Zalman Shazara speaking. If they, the Tsarist authorities, take the recruits themselves, they will snatch children and Torah students from whose midst future sages may come. If I, however, deliver them myself, I will choose the simpletons, thus saving those who are the most promising. Concluding his remarks, President Shazar added that the path which Gens took and for which he had been condemned may have been similar to the one his forebears chose a century before him. And I have to say, this is a very, very insightful statement. It's something to think about. The Cantonists, the selection, the memoir literature. Go into Chabad and look at some of the Chabad memoir literature of the period, and you'll see that the leaders of the community acted exactly the way most of the leaders of the Judenrat acted in the Hitler period, lo aleinu. That these are times where our back is against the wall and we face the horrible choice between blood to blood, Jew to Jew, person to person, child to child, student to student. Who remembers what happened in YU? Why did this become a cause celebre? Oh boy. Let's see what you know of your contemporary history. No? Yitzchak, do you remember? Oh boy. Oh boy, the Rebbe, it's not ancient history. Not ancient history. What happened was, Reb Heschel Schechter, one of his volumes, so he mentions that the reason the Rav went to Berlin was to run away from the army. Got it? 1, 2, 3. The Peshel Shechter mentions that the Polish Republic had been organized after World War I, and they had a draft for the army. And the Rav was of draft age. So one of the reasons he went to Berlin was to avoid the army. And Reb Heschel threw in that going to the army would have been horrendous because it involved 25 years, etc. Another Schechter, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schechter, criticized him vocally and vociferously all over New York in many lectures, greater New York area, that the Cantonists, what's he talking about? The Russian, Polish army was 2 years, 3 years. Cantonist period was back in the 1820s, the 1830s, the 1840s. By the middle of the 1850s, even Russia couldn't be so cruel. So there was a tremendous debate, and that's where Rabbi J.J. Schechter gets involved in becoming an expert on, recreating history, restating history, re-forging the facts or recreating the facts. And he went into many examples, including this example. If you read my work on the Rav and you read my footnote on this, it's a very long footnote that was fine-tuned, Shaya, many times over. Because, Reb Heschel, it was a slip of the pen. Reb Heschel is not an academic scholar. He's a great Talmud Chacham. When you write something like this in academia, you have to be very careful. On the other hand, I think we'll all agree that the prospect of Mori Rebbe going into the Polish army was not a happy prospect. It's not exactly the Israeli army where people learn Torah and people daven and Kashrus is observed and Shabbat is observed and it's a Jewish army and everyone has the right to have tefillin on their chagorah, on their army belt. So the very fact that he faced being drafted was one of the catalysts that encouraged the Rav to leave for Berlin at that moment in time. That is correct. That's what should have been stated. But to compare it to the Cantonist is incorrect. Let's test your knowledge one step further. Which Gadol Shebegadolim did serve in the Russian army in World War I? The Stipler Rav. That is correct. Rav Yaakov Yisrael Kanevsky, the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, served in the Russian army, and what did he come away with that all his life he suffered, although he viewed it as a blessing? He was hard of hearing as a result. From the cannons going off, the shooting, he lost part of his hearing, which is a problem for anyone in artillery, including the Israeli army, even though they give you, what do you call them, earplugs to put into your ear. But still, I've been on a battlefield, there's a tremendous amount of noise on a battle and a war and shooting, etc. But why did the Stipler view it as a blessing? Because when you're hard of hearing, you do not hear Rechilut and Lashon Hara. So you see, even in this difficulty that he bore, he saw a blessing. Okay. My dear students, I'll take a question in a second, but we've now come to the high point, and it's unbelievable where we're going from here. But give me 1 second. Zev, what do you want to ask?
I heard something. I'm not sure if it's true. I thought maybe the Rebbe could tell us. I heard that the Ashkenazi minhag of not wearing a talit gadol until they get
married,
had something to do with avoiding draft, maybe not the Cantonese, but from before, or that it was more common among Ashkenazi countries.
That you mean what? That they didn't, that they couldn't wear a talit in the army.
They didn't want them to know when they were 12, when they were 13.
Uh-huh.
And until they were already married.
You would have to look that up in Tamei Hadinim Uminhagim. And see whether he brings that down. Where did you hear that? That's interesting. In other words, you're saying that they didn't put on a talit.
I heard
a different theory that they were poor and no one could afford a talit. But the father-in-law, that was part of the deal of the wedding, that the father-in-law had to come across with a talit.
Ashkenazi followed this ridiculous.
Rabbi Rubin is in favor of all bar mitzvah boys wearing a talit. I want to tell you I am opposed. Watch. Rabbi Rubin, you
want to make the shit
of me? Let me tell you a little story. A very close family relationship. This girl was on the border. She was from a Ramaz class. If I had any seichel, I would write a book, The Class of 1962, Revisited, and I could buy Griff's Campus, if that book. It's a lot different than writing about the Rav and writing about the Ritbaz and writing about Reb Lazer Silver and et cetera, et cetera. The Class of 62, Revisited. This was a class of Ramaz caught up already between Torah and feminism. What happened to that class is unbelievable. One of them married an Arab, but there's a Hasidic Rebbe's granddaughter. She lives in the Mishulash. One of them became a hater of men, that Enkadug Matol, the editor of Lilith. God have mercy. I know their names. I want to mention their names. Others married, got divorced, others became lesbians. This woman, who's very closely related to me, always remained from, but no boy was good enough, she's making a living, she has a master's, and, you know, this is part of the feminism. Women are smarter than men, it's an open Gemara. Okay, I don't argue with an open Gemara, neither. David is lucky his wife condescended to marry him. You understand? We're lucky if the woman condescends to marry us. And that's why girls go out with boys, but yeah, Rebbe's immature. I say, that's your job. I got to tell a different Torah to make him relax. We're all men are immature. God. So this was the feminist thrust. Now I'm being very serious. And this girl was caught up in it. The years go by, you know, when you're 20, you're going to be 20 forever, blind, and you're independent. Suddenly you're 30. And boy, when you're 30, do those years start to run. Is this the little boy I carried? Is this the little girl I played? No, help me out. I don't remember growing older. When did they? Thank you. That song has Kedusha to it. There's mamish Kedusha in that. So I know people who became frum through Fiddler on the Roof. Could you imagine? I know people who became frum. American Goyim saw it. And the Kiddush scene and tradition, I know people who became frum. What are you laughing at? That play has a big schut. So... you talk about time flying. So this girl already is in her late 30s. In a young Israel, someone noticed from the women's section that there's a man sitting there without a talit. Looks like he's late 30, early 40. They went over to him. Are you married? He said, no. P.S. It's many years later, 4 children later. Miracle of miracles. Thank God he wasn't wearing a talis. Had he been wearing a talis, no one would have known that he's single. So you see, Rabbi Reuben is right from the pure Litvisha standpoint. He comes from Boston. He comes from Maimonides. Mazel tov, Moshe, and enjoy the wedding. Regards to your wife, but don't miss the end of the shiur, make it up. And Rabbi Reuben is right, that our peace, seichel hilchati, what kind of shkatzim are they? Mitzvah boliot chal tach mitzenu, your yud gimel, medafan tana talis, like the yekis do, like the svatim do. It's beautiful, it's nice. And I want to be malam etzchut and klal Yisrael. I'm the happiest person alive, because they're 4 wonderful B'nai Torah in this world as a result of that young man who was in his early 40s not wearing a talis in a young Israel in Queens and a woman looking down and noticing it.
Could just mismatch his socks.
Well, this is not arguing with the Rebbe.
Let's go. My dear friends, everything we've learned in this heartbreaking, heartrending topic is halacha lemaisa at this very moment in the state of Israel. It is on the news today in particular. It is something that haunts us. And I want to show you, you think that the Kapos and Judenrat is ancient history? You think that the Cantonists is something we study in graduate school? No. We have a burning issue today. 3 soldiers were kidnapped, kicked off the second Lebanese War, they call it. 2 of the soldiers, let me state it clear and simple, I'm not alive. The Israeli government will announce it shortly. There are political reasons. They have to decide for their reasons when to announce it. But one is alive. The Shalit boy, down south. He's in the hands of Hamas. For whatever the reasons are, there is no chance that Israel can pull off a raid and try to redeem him. They may not even know exactly where he's being held. I don't know what the Israeli intelligence knows, what doesn't know, but it's quite obvious they cannot pull off a raid. Now, we have established a terrible practice that goes against the halakha, I'll give you the sources later, of paying a tremendous price to redeem our soldiers. It was a terrible mistake to begin. When you start giving away 200 for one and 400 for one and 500 for one, it is a terrible mistake and it is against the halakha. But you have to understand something. As I read to you a few minutes ago from one of the leaders of the Judenrat, we're Jews. And every child is precious to us. More than that. We have a very unique situation here. It's not like the United States that fought World War II, that fought in Vietnam, that before that fought in Korea, that today is fighting in Iraq. The wars are fought far from the borders, and when the parents see their children shipped overseas, they cannot pick up a phone to the commander and tell the commander what to do. In the state of Israel, there's no state without borders. The borders are the state. Where we are sitting right now, one can walk to Arab terrorism. I would say all it will take is 40 minutes. 40 minutes and you're in East Jerusalem, if that long. Believe me, Menachem Mendel walks it quicker than 40 minutes. I see him at times. So you have here, and this has, by the way, tremendous halakhic implications. You have here a little country which has a citizen army where until recently everyone was a member of the IDF, and you're sitting in a room with two AKs who came in Aliyah in older age. Yitzhak was an officer in the IDF. I have a battle ribbon from 82. Everyone's in the army. Until recently, today, it's a different story. Haredim don't serve. Some of the leftists don't serve. But until recently, and even today, it's still a citizen army. And parents have tremendous input into the army. It's a small country. Everyone knows everyone else. How many people do you know who were arrested in America? Someone gets arrested. You know, people I know, I just fainted Wednesday night, when they announced some psychologist, some social worker, slash therapist, was arrested in Jerusalem. It's a why you pin up boy. Who doesn't know? Remained for 5 days. Who knows what's going to happen now? The charges, frightening. I say to myself, in America, I never knew anyone. I knew one person who was arrested, the Levy in my shul. Outside of that Levy, I didn't know anyone else. Here I can give you a long list of people who were arrested, sat in jail, talking people I know, people I daven with. This person is actually who was related to me through marriage for a while. It's unbelievable.
Some family, though.
You got it. It's my mother's second husband. My mother is all excited. She says he always spoke fresh to her tomorrow. So I told my mother, talking fresh to your father-in-law and what he's accused of, I told my mother it's got a long way to go. You know, I said that he shouldn't spoke in fresh. You don't speak fresh to your father-in-law, period. You don't speak fresh to an older Jew. But my mother said, I used to tell him, you don't speak that way. But I told my mother, he's got a long way to go to what he's accused of. He has mazel, because the day he was arrested was the day they killed the murderer up in Lebanon. So the Jerusalem Post did not have an article. All the other papers had articles with his picture, and the Post has limited space, so he was left out. Baruch Hashem. Anyway, it's a small country. Everyone knows everyone else. And the pressure on the defense ministers, on the prime ministers, is overwhelming. And I have to say, Yitzhak Rabin, I can't reveal everything I know in these areas. There's something involved here that grew out of this class that if I could ever tell the whole story, you would be proud to say you knew Aaron Rakefet. Till then, don't be proud. But I can't tell the whole story. I can only tell, that's not for now, a little bit surfaced in Haaretz and Yediot. Anyway, in Maariv, my name got thrown in properly for the first time, with a first name too, Rav Aaron Rakefet. My grandchildren were overjoyed. Finally, they can boast about their grandfather to Israelis. It's a small country. And I have to say about Yitzhak Rabin, with all that I differ with him politically, and with all that I don't believe in the Rabin heritage, which they try to force down our throats every November, he was a very emotional, good person. You have to understand something. And these people, he meant well. They mean well. They dream of peace. They mean well. I'll be melamed zchut. He cracked under the pressure of parents. And you understand, if it's your child, who are we talking about? Who are we talking about? If it's your child, how would you feel? You know, it's one thing to say, 500 is wrong, 400 is wrong, 300 is wrong, what type of price? It's against the halacha. I'll give you the sources soon. But if it's your child, what would you say? Okay. Yeah, but then there's another aspect. Did you hear the radio today? General Stern, Major General. Lusa Stern, you know what I'm talking about? The head of manpower in the army. A graduate of Nativ Meir. General Stern spoke today at a, I don't know what it was, a think tank. And they played his voice. I know him, so I recognized the voice right away. He a number of times has done that, my minion at the Kotel when he's there Friday night. So he said, yes, we have to do everything to redeem a soldier. But on the other hand, he said, think how many more civilians and soldiers will die by our redeeming him. He said it openly. And he said what we all know, that every time we release 500 for one, 400 for one, 300 for one, 200 for one, even if only 10% go back to terrorist activity, think for a minute what we're talking about. 20 out of 200. 40 out of 400. 50 out of 500. And inevitably, the statistics show something like 16 to 17%. Even though they signed, they will not go back to terrorist activity, etc., etc. No, they signed. We all signed phony documents. It's the big deal. Right or wrong? I'm a trustee of some charity. They give me papers. Do I know what I'm signing? I depend upon them. I forgot.
Did you sign a phony visa to get into Russia?
We signed phony documents to go to Russia. Absolutely, absolutely. With a false identity and a false this and a false... Absolutely. Believe me, the first time I went in, you know, I write in my book, I was shivering. You know, I don't want to play the role of a big shot. I never was afraid. I was afraid plenty. The first time. Once I saw how the game works, the second time, no longer afraid. The third time we danced, it was perestroika, it was a different ballpark. But look at the responsibility I took in sending so many people. Just think for a minute. David Applebaum, Hashem Yitom Damo, wound up in jail. I mean, just think, that's a responsibility. But you know that A.B. Weingart went to Rav Shlomo Zalman and asked him whether he should go or not. If he went, he asked him. So Rav Shlomo Zalman told him to ask me, what is the worst that has happened? So I told him. I said, the worst that has happened, if you are people were smacked around on the street, and David wound up in jail overnight. So Rav Shlomo Zalman paskened he should go. And he became one of my greatest shlichim ever. It's Rav Avraham Abba Weingart, the Talmud Mufak of the Sri Yesh, who puts out all his svarim. But just think for a minute what I'm saying. You're going to redeem one soldier, and you're going to kill, God have mercy, I don't even want to state statistics, tens of civilians and other soldiers by letting out these murderers. Do you see the quagmire you have here? You're living it right now at this moment. Sure, you wear big shots. We're sitting here criticizing the Prime Minister, criticizing the Minister of Defense. Believe me, I have a lot to criticize them. Don't think for one second that I agree with their general outlook. But they have a tremendous decision to make. This is literally a replay of the Holocaust. What do you do? Give up one life to save many lives? Or no, you have to save that life, and what happens afterwards is God's business, not ours. Okay? It's mind-boggling. It's more to it. But let me give you the first sources. Sources are very fascinating here. Gemara in Gittin, it's a Mishnah in Gittin with a Gemara, Daf Mem Hei Amid Aleph. Baruch, taking notes?
I'm going to get it from the website.
Check the sources. My Rebbe used to say, Otiyot Machkimot. I say it, Otiyot Machkimot. Got it? See it inside. Note the Mishnah in Gittin, Daf Mem Hei Amid Aleph. Ein poldim et ashvuim yeter al kadei to make him with neitikin olam. You're not allowed to redeem shvuim more than they're worth. With neitikin olam, it's very obvious. The minute you agree to pay 500 for one, well, next time they want 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And this is what's happened. There's a whole history of 100, 200. The only one that ever arranged a one-to-one transfer was Yonah Baumel. He was negotiating with. That's a whole story. I ought to have Yonah come here one day and tell you the story. It's worth hearing. Yonah Baumel, the father of the soldier missing from 82, Zach Baumel, the Hezda boy from Alon Shvut. Zach Baumel, it's his father. He once arranged a transfer one-for-one. And he wrote a letter to the editor in the Jerusalem Post this last year that they're crazy. And then he was an op-ed. It's terrible. Ain point in. Now, Ibayelahu. So the Gemara asks, Hai mitnei tikkun olam mishum duchatad tziburahu alduma the lowly brave the late day tvei. The Gemara asks, what is the reason? What is the tikkun ha'olam? What is the reason? Okay, one reason can be you don't want to impoverish the community. It's one of our big problems today with day school education, with Moistas HaTorah. You know, the Shpinkat Rebbe, the defense is going to be that the Rebbe didn't take a cent for himself, but that the money was used for the institutions. But you can't have institutions if you can't afford to cover them. It's a terrible problem. What's the question?
What's the story?
Not in Israel. In America, it's not so new. It's already a month and a half ago. There were Yitzchak Norbeck will fill you in. He knows some of the people. There were big arrests in L.A. And it turns out they were laundering money. And it's a terrible story. I don't know. It made the New York Times and every local Jewish paper. And when the trial begins, I pray there be a plea bargain, because if the trial begins in public, which it will, the whole world will be in on the gossip and on the story and on the shtick. But the defense is, when I understand it's true, that the Rebbe himself didn't take money. It was for his institutions. Okay.
He's dealing with the mafia.
He's dealing with the Jewish mafia. It's not going. It's Yiddish mention. Among them, leaders of the OU, among them, something you own is today Treif Pussel. That you don't know. You own it. And the family has gone ballistic. The Machzor, the Rav, take a look at the name. The first thing you see on the binding, the edition, look at that name. Then come to me and I'll tell you about this safer you have in your possession, and you will be ashamed.
The interesting of Oscar Schottenstein also was involved.
No. Yitzchak, please. The Shpinkat Rebbe. his gabbai and some friends of Yitznovak. Okay, that's what it amounts to.
One of them was a sofer
also. I don't want to go into more detail. There are details there with their two of them with their wives. It defies imagination, but it's not for now. But you see, if you're going to impoverish the tzibur, you cannot do that. You can't have the tzibur. We need money to live. We need money to have food. We need money to dress. We need money to have a roof over our heads. You can't impoverish the tzibur. We need money so our children can get married. We need money so our children can get education. So that's one reason. Or maybe there's a different reason, that if you start in poverty, if you start robbing and pay a big sum, they'll rob 100 more, they'll rob 200 more. It's like paintings, like artwork. It's fabulous. It's like robbing the silver era today. You sell it on the website, you get $100 for the silver era. Ribbono shel Olam. Now, so you see what this means is, even if you have the money, for the sake of argument, look into Rashi. Rashi says, you have a wealthy father. I'm quoting Rashi. You have a wealthy father. Look, your father says, I'm willing to pay $1,000 to redeem my son, $10,000, whatever they want. And he has the money. It's not a problem. For him, this $10,000 is like, it's like for me to spend $10. It's nothing. Yeah, but there's a problem. Because David, if you pay that money, you entice him to come along and rob more and more Jews. So the Gemara raises this question. You look into the Rambam, Hilchot Matanot Aniyim. The Rambam deals with it when he deals with charity. Perek Chet Halacha Yud Bet. And he says, plain and simple, that Ein podim et ashluyim b'yeter al demehim if they tikkun olam. And he gives a reason. Shelo yihiyu ha'ayvim rotfim acharechem lishbotam. So they shouldn't start trying to capture every Jew. It's like, again, artwork. If you can rob a Rembrandt and resell it and get away with it, wow, in 1 year you've made enough money to live on the rest of your life. So another thief sees, well, he got away with it, so he goes for a Chagall. This one goes for a Monet. And before you know it, every museum in the world, and by the way, it's a big problem today. Plenty of museums, particularly in Europe, it seems, are not that well guarded. And artwork disappears, and no one knows what happens to it because they can't sell it on the open market. It evidently is someone who said to some thief, if you can get me a Monet, I'll give you $2 million. But a guy comes in with a Monet, the thief has it, I don't know where he exhibits it, but keeps it in his bedroom, looks at it when he goes to sleep at night. No, but the Rambam Paskins, like the Lushan, that it has to do, it's not a question of money, it's a question of encouraging them to rob more and more. And that's the exact point that was made by an op-ed piece in the Jerusalem Post, that if we pay 500 soldiers to get to the 500 thieves, murderers, to get Shalit back, we are encouraging them to rob more and more Israeli soldiers. And the time has come to say, one for one, not anymore. Now, look into Yoredeya, Hilchat Staka, Siman Resh Nun Bet, Sivkatan Dalit, and he paskins like the Rambam, paraphrases the Rambam and makes it even clearer. Ein podina shvuyam yotem ichtei demeihem, mipnei tukin olam, shalo yiyu hayavim mosrim atzmom aleim lishpotam. That we don't redeem the shvuyim more than they're worth. Because the minute we pay more, our enemies will be moiser nefesh. to rob more and more Jews. And this is true in life. This is true protection money. The minute you pay protection money once, you're going to wind up paying protection money 100 times over. Absolutely true. Now let me ask a question. Talk about pidgin shvuya. All right, what does pidgin shvuya mean? You're redeeming someone. Tell me. What about if his life is in danger? Well, let's spell it out. If we don't redeem Shalit, at a certain point they're going to execute him. Well, what do they need him for? The whole reason they need him is he's a bargaining chip. And they have a tremendous appetite. And you can understand why they have a tremendous appetite, because we have accustomed them to getting a lot of meat in return for one soldier. We have paid 200, 300, 400, 500. It's a mind-boggling what the exchanges that have taken place. If we don't redeem him, he's dead. If they reach the conclusion he's worthless to them, he's dead. No, look into the Pitchei Tshuva. Right there at the bottom of the Amud in the Yoredeya, Sif Dalid, and he brings a machloket achronim. Some achronim say that if there's fear of death, that they're going to kill him, you go crazy to redeem him, you pay a fortune. And other achronim say, you'll see the sources, Ela afilu ba'omeid lahariga ein podin yoter michtei tamav. Even if they're going to kill him, that's the halacha. You don't pay more than he is worth. Think of the implication. In other words, Shalit has been captured. With all our emotion, with all our feeling, we may be related to him, but even if they kill him, that's the halacha. You cannot pay more than he's worth, or it will start an endless process. By the way, I can tell you, Ryan, that you have that in South Africa today. Do you know that a third person was killed a few days ago? I know people who know her.
More than a third.
What'd you say?
You're saying people killed.
The third that I know of in the last few weeks. What do you know of?
I was told of five or six.
Five or six. And they say the police are powerless. Unbelievable. But what bothers me is they're going to wind up in Sydney and where you're going, Beverly Hills. I want them here. The smart ones are coming here. But it's terrible. Terrible. But you see, once they got away with it once, you can rob and kill twice, thrice, you tell me four, five. I was Menachem Ava last night, Herman Cohn, Zichron Levercha, his son Shep was one of my early students in Israel. I know it's the widow, wonderful people. There were people there who knew this woman who was just killed. Unbelievable. What a source. What a quagmire. What a difficulty. And here you have it right now. You have to, right, we're living it. This is not the Holocaust. This is not the Cantonists. This is right now. We're yelling, we're shouting, we're writing letters to the editor. No, what do you do? Do you redeem him? Pay the price? Or no, Hatzalat Klal Yisrael. It's a lot deeper. I'll show you.
One of it says there's a comparison between paying money and letting murderers go. And if anything, you'd say the hefech, that letting the murderers go is endangering Klal Yisrael.
I'm saying that's exactly the point. That's why I'm inclined to say that here endangering Klal Yisrael, we don't redeem him no matter what, even if his parents have all the money in the world. And even if he's going to be killed, I'm showing you the sources. I agree with you. It supports my interpretation of the Nota B'Yehuda. But wait till next week. I'm going to turn it all around. Want to give you one more source. No, where do we have a source, the most famous source of all in our Torah history? Sha'alis rufa ba'esh. No, k'tinat Tisha B'Av, the Maran Mirutenberg. Don't we have the famous story of the Maran that we all grew up on when we were kids? I mean, every Tisha B'Av, any rabbi worth his salt would tell the story when he introduced, he wrote the kina, Sha'alistu. Do you know the background of that kina? The Catholic
the
Church.
The
correct. The Catholic Church, thank you, Menachem Mendel. The Catholic Church, it was what, 1292, Mashahu Kazet. The Catholic, 1294, it's around then. The Catholic Church burned endless Kitvei Yad in Paris.
And
it's later. It's during the Maram, they may have burned a few times. But this is a later time. This is a later time. 1215. God have mercy. God have mercy. The Maran Mirutenberg is years of 1220 to 1293. And it was towards the middle end of his life. And you understand what it meant to burn manuscripts? Today we have print, we have Xerox, but we can do wonders. Then if you burned the manuscript, hundreds and hundreds of people used that manuscript. That was all they had. And the Maran Rottenberg saw that Torah is going to go way down the world, all those svarim gone. And he decided it's time to go on Aliyah. And a whole group of Jews were meeting, were traveling, and they were planning Aliyah. And while he was traveling, a converted Jew, a Meshumad, recognized him, told the bishop about it, and the bishop had him seized, and he was delivered. This was in Germany, on his way to Hamburg, to sail for Israel with a group of people, and this Meshumad snitched on him. He was seized, and he was put into a tower, into a jail, where he remained the rest of his life. The Jews wanted to redeem him. They were willing to pay a fortune to gain his freedom. And the Maran Mirutenberg refused, wouldn't let them to redeem him. I'm quoting now from Mark Samagolis, page 383. The rabbi declined to be set free, lest a precedent should be established whereby any ruler might extort money from the Jews by seizing their rabbi. He died in the fortress. Not only that, died in the fortress, and they wouldn't release his body for burial. And this went on and on till about 1307, if my memory is correct, when a wealthy Jew, Alexander Zuskin Wimpfen, redeemed him, paid a huge ransom on condition that he be buried next to the Maran Mirutenberg. And believe it or not, these two graves survive. You can visit them. People have visited. I've seen pictures. They survived the Hitler period. And they survived until today, the Maran Mirutenberg and the Balabas, the Nagid, as we call him in modern Hebrew, who paid the ransom to redeem his body 13 years after his death. So you see, tradition comes down on the side of not redeeming. Ein podine tashlum yotel demei demeichem. It has to do not so much with lack of money, even if you have the money, but by redeeming, you encourage them to rob and steal. And it could even be when someone faces death. Think what we're talking about. Someone faces death. We don't redeem him. Because the minute you allow him to be redeemed, you are starting a process that will involve and destroy so many other Jews. And here you have the terrible situation with Shalit. The price they want, how many more people will die if they pay that price? And it's literally facing a quagmire, facing a decision, Hashem Yirachem, exactly like the Cantonists, and very similar to the words of the various leaders of the ghetto, of the Judenrat, the same tragedy. Do we sacrifice one life to save other lives? And this problem stares at us at this very moment. Now, I have a tremendous addendum to make that'll open your eyes, but I have to leave that for next week. And then we move on. We have the Judenrat behind us. I think we've done justice to the topic. I want you to know that I've even written to members of Hillel Zeidman's family to tell them about my defense of their father, grandfather, and citing Chaim Shalem's doctorate, which they may or may not be aware of because they're in America and they're not exactly in academia. And to know about Chaim Shalem's doctorate, you need a little bit mazel. You see, many doctorates are published, but you need mazel to know what's going on, to uncover it, to be abreast of it. So much scholarship is happening in the world, and you have to be able to keep abreast of it. So let me reiterate. What did we do today? We finished out the Judenrat. The problem haunts. I can go on and on. This ghetto, that ghetto. Lo aleinu. Each one took a different point of view, although the majority went with the Kavna Rav, and there are examples in Trunk's work where they didn't cooperate at first, but when they saw what happened, they changed their minds. Shazan's analogy to the Cantonists is brilliant and worthy of our admiration. It's very insightful, and again, it haunts us. And then I went one step further. I want to thank my student, Dr. Avi Freilich, from Queens, who encouraged me to see if there'd be any practical implication, and it hit me between the eyes that the Shalit case stares us in the eyes, but I'm not finished. I have one addendum to make. Now, tomorrow, I wouldn't miss for anything. I'm giving the Divrei Torah, be punctual, because I'm finishing out Birchat HaTorah, finishing out Torah Shebaal Peh, and the first part of the She'ur, you'll have Divrei Torah that you'll be able to quote for the next 70 years. You'll be able to quote in the rabbinate, in the classroom, etc. And then I go on, Pinchas' question, who is Reb Moshe Feinstein? The world of Reb Moshe Feinstein. Now, and then tomorrow, I have special pictures that it's 99 grand to see them, but because I'm in a generous mood, it's on the house. The only one who will pay 99 grand is yours truly, because to uncover such pictures of the Rav, you have to be able to give away 99 grand in gratitude. So put me on the IO list. Will you tell Jack to put me on the IOU list? Gentlemen, Hamayan, the latest issue. Anyone who wants it, welcome. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Educating for Prayer.
I'll give it to you next week.
Give it to this gentleman. Mayor Soloveitchik just wrote a piece on beards. He is terrific. That's the new generation taking over the world. My student, beards. Zakan Alapanim. My student, Mark Shapiro, the Svarim blog, he's carrying on something unbelievable.